From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, maggots, spoiled food, dirty kitchens, sex with inmates, and more. What will it take to fire Aramark from feeding Michigan's prisoners?
Look, we're paying this company $50 million a year to do a job. Are we getting our money's worth?
Detroit prepares to mark 1 year since its historic bankruptcy filing.
I think we've seen a kind of leadership and coalescence in this community, the likes of which people in my line of work, I've never seen it.
Fish hatcheries, they've been important in Michigan for much longer than you'd think.
Even by the 1870s, that people think as the good old days, our fisheries resources were in decline, serious decline across the basin.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. The private company that provides food to Michigan prisons is in trouble again. Sex with inmates, maggots in the food, smuggling drugs to inmates. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's Stateside, when is enough enough with Aramark, the food service company hired 7 months ago to feed Michigan's inmates? Then the Senate dug deeper into GM's deadly recalls, demanding the automaker fire its chief lawyer and open its compensation plan to more potential victims. We get the latest on today's hearings later this hour. But first, tomorrow afternoon at 4:06 is the one-year anniversary of the largest municipal bankruptcy filing in American history. It was the day Governor Rick Snyder decided it was past time to act.
This is the time to say enough is enough in terms of the downward decline of Detroit. The 700,000 people of Detroit deserve a better answer. What this does by going to bankruptcy court is give us one forum to say let's address these issues in a thoughtful, deliberate fashion. And this has been done after going through a very deliberative process to come to that decision and to recognize there were no other viable alternatives.
This week, Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes has been talking with top business leaders for a temperature check on how they feel this first year of bankruptcy is gone. Daniel, DTE Energy's vice chairman Dave Meador said a year and a half ago, if you told a number of us this was going to happen, we wouldn't have believed it. What is it?
That's a lot of things. I mean, I think he made those comments yesterday at the second grand bargain press conference at the DIA, where the DIA has been trotting out the people who are contributing to their portion of the grand bargain. But I think it's a lot more than that, as I interpret it. I mean, it's the city cutting $7 billion in debt prospectively. It's finding money to prop up pensions from within the community. It's not selling the art. It's a whole host of things. It's union and pension fund leaders ultimately looking at surveying what is a pretty bleak landscape and probably making the most responsible decision in terms of telling their members we need to back the grand bargain, which essentially makes them allies of the city and of Governor Rick Snyder and of the Republican leadership in the legislature. I think we've seen a kind of leadership and coalescence in this community, the likes of which people in my line of work, I've never seen it. And I came here in 1993 to Southeast Michigan, and I've never seen anything like it. And you talk to people who spent their whole lives here, and they would tell you the same thing.
Whom do business leaders, for example, Matt Cullen, who's president and CEO of Rock Financial, credit for all of this?
Well, I think they start, as Matt said to me yesterday, he starts with Judge Rhodes, who's overseeing the bankruptcy, and Judge Rosen, who's leading a team of federal mediators. But I don't think you can stop there. I think what people see, and I see it too, is a real confluence of leadership, a very unique period in time where you have a Republican governor who's not acting like a caricatured Republican in Lansing, a Democrat who's the mayor of Detroit, who's really not acting like a stereotypical Democrat. He tends to be pro-business. He moves quickly. He doesn't check everything with whether the unions are going to like it or not like it. You've got Kevin Orr and his bankruptcy team. You've got even suburban leaders who I think are showing some support. Suburban taxpayers who, when polled, and even outstate voters, when polled about the grand bargain, a surprising majority, surprisingly large majority, supported using taxpayer funds to get the grand bargain finished. I mean, and even the pensioners, who a lot of whom made a lot of noise on our websites and other websites that they were going to vote no, and clearly there were people that did vote no, but there was a lot, from what we can tell, a much larger majority who just kept their mouth shut and are voting yes because they're taking a deal that probably is the best deal that they can get.
And you're touching on the point that needs to be highlighted and not glossed over, and the fact that this has and will hurt people like the pensioners. But as you point out, a lot of people thought a year ago that the banks and the big money companies aren't going to be hit, and they are.
Well, and that's exactly right. And I think that's why you have a few financial holdouts who are squawking really loud, and it's going to get louder when the trial begins in mid-August. The trial for the actual confirmation trial, where the judge goes through this and then says, okay, this is the plan, and we're going to go forward with this. Now, it's going to be a very important and large part of that whole trial is going to be determining whether the plan that the city is putting forth is what they call feasible, that is, sustainable and financially viable. Because what they don't want is to take the risk of what's called a Chapter 18, meaning they go out of Chapter 9 and then they go back into Chapter 9, so it becomes a Chapter 18. So that's going to be a big part of it, but I think you're going to see financial creditors still making an awful lot of noise and saying that the grand bargain and everything that it represents is a community and a state kind of banding together around an idea and a concept that is politically palatable at the expense of lenders. And there have been other lenders who've cut deals with the city, and after multiple negotiations, and they're, to use the haircut metaphor, they were getting more and more haircut off every time they redid the deal. So this whole notion that the banks aren't paying and the little folks are is just not true. In a lot of ways, when you look, if you're a police or firefighter retiree at the city of Detroit, you would get 100% of your pension. Now, you would lose about half of your cost of living adjustment, and no question, retiree health care is being impacted by this. But I think this is a lot better outcome than a lot of people feared at the outset.
You make a real interesting point in your column in today's news, Daniel, that the timing of this bankruptcy really worked in its favor, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. Think back to where we were in 2009. You had the two iconic companies in a federally induced bankruptcy. You had Ford Motor Company, while it wasn't there, it was fighting for its life. I mean, it had money in the bank, and it was able to fight through it. You had a leadership in Lansing that was terribly divided. Governor Granholm and the Republicans in the Senate simply could not get anything meaningful done. And even Andy Dillon, who is the Speaker and a Democrat in the House, was often at loggerheads with the governor. And she also was somebody who I think typically was afraid to kind of stand up to her own union base when it was needed. I just don't see, if the situation had reached such critical mass financially for the city 4 years ago, that she would have even taken him into bankruptcy, or she may have been forced to do so, but it would have been a lot more not as well planned. I think you have evidence here of a governor and a team that saw this coming for some period of time, and some people would argue that they may have induced it with a revised emergency manager law, but the net effect is, I think when you put it all together, you also had a business community in the city of Detroit that's very energized. As I quoted it late in the piece, Dan Lepp, the CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan, who said, you know, we started to see what was happening in downtown, and it wasn't just Gilbert. It began much earlier than that. It began with Peter Carmanos bringing CompuWare down, and then there was another thing, and then there was Gilbert, and things were starting to happen, and people wanted to be a part of it, and they could see with the corruption trial of Kwame Kilpatrick, with some of the other public corruption investigations that the U.S. attorney is doing, that things are really starting to change here, and they were changing for the good. And as he put it, people didn't want to let go, and they still don't want to let go. I mean, you had Roger Penske and the Penske Corp make a $10 million contribution pledge to the grand bargain, which is twice what Dan Gilbert and the Quicken family have done. I mean, that ought to tell you something. These are people that, I mean, Roger Penske doesn't need to do this. Mm-hmm. But they want to be part of it, and as he put it, and I really like this metaphor, they don't want to let go. They want to be part of this turnaround story, and they're going to do what they can to help the mayor, to help the governor, to help each other. You know, Roger Penske led a campaign to raise money for ambulances and cop cars for the city of Detroit, which you see, if you're in the city, you see all over the place. You know, these are meaningful things, and they're symbolic to the people that live there, and they see these things happening.
How do you think all of this will serve to set things up for the confirmation trial that starts August 14th?
Well, I think, unfortunately, some of the stuff we're talking about here to Judge Rhodes is probably ancillary. I mean, he knows it exists. He lives in this community. He's practiced and served on the bench here for a long time. But I think at the end of the day, he has to call balls and strikes in the courtroom. This is a capstone to his career. There's no question about it. It would be for any judge. But, you know, after this, he's expected to go on what's called recall status, which is kind of like semi-retirement. So this is his big deal, and he wants to do it right, and he wants to call balls and strikes down the middle. He doesn't want to be perceived as being favoring one side or the other. And you can see even this week he pushed back on the city a little bit on their how they were doing their water shutoffs, and he's done those kinds of things in the past. So I think really this is going to be more of a very technical exercise. But I think we have a better sense about how this is going to play out now that it appears the pensioners and the two classes of pensioners have approved the grand bargain. Now, we'll know that for sure on Monday when the city is supposed to enter a filing with the court that says exactly what the outcome of the vote was. But our reporting and reporting of other news organizations all is in line. I suspect we're talking to a lot of the same people that this passed by a pretty comfortable margin.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
This news coming out from the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. The MDEQ has denied permission for a company to store piles of pet coke on the Detroit River. Pet coke is a byproduct of refining tar sands petroleum. The letter denying the permit says Detroit Bulk Storage did not have an adequate plan to control potentially toxic blowing dust. The company can still submit a new plan to the state. You can learn more about pet coke. Just go to michiganradio.org. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today brought the fourth appearance for General Motors CEO Mary Barra before angry members of Congress. This time, a Senate subcommittee took a deeper dive into the ignition switch recalls and didn't like what it saw in GM's legal department. Michigan Radio's auto reporter Tracy Samuelton is here. So, Tracy, who was most in the uncomfortable Senate spotlight today?
Well, there's no doubt that this time it was GM's general counsel, Mike Milligan. He's a 37-year veteran of this company. And some of this ignition switch recall situation did happen on his watch. He's been in that job since 2009. And there were senior attorneys who were fired, but apparently that didn't go far enough for some of the members of the committee. And not 5 minutes into the hearing, the chairwoman, Claire McCaskill, had this to say.
How in the world, in the aftermath of this report, did Michael Milliken keep his job?
So well. Basically, it's a buck stops here argument. You know, even though you didn't know, your underlings knew, and you should leave. That very difficult situation. And I have to say, GM CEO Mary Barra was really adamant in her defense of Mr. Milliken.
And Mike Milliken is a man of incredibly high integrity. He has tremendous global experience as it relates to the legal profession. He's the person I need on this team. He had a system in place. Unfortunately, in this instant, it wasn't brought to his attention, frankly, by people who brought many other issues forward.
Ooh, so this is really looking into when did you know and what didn't you tell us after you knew?
Right. And he's basically saying, I didn't know any sooner than Mary Barra. I did not know until February of this year that these deaths had happened because of the ignition switch issue.
Now, Delphi supplied the ignition switches, and its CEO, Rodney O'Neill, was also there before the Senate today. How did things go for him?
Well, I think the members of the subcommittee were relatively gentle with Mr. O'Neill. He testified that he was concerned about this, that Delphi has in fact done a review of its safety policies, and it looks as if an engineer working on a part has a safety concern, they're going to encourage that person to bring it up. But he was asked, you know, are you responsible at all for the situation? You made the part that was defective. And he had this to say.
Our product met the requirements of the customer.
So no responsibility?
No.
And, you know, GM CEO Mary Barra said, that's absolutely correct. We're the automaker. We ordered the part. We are responsible. So nobody in this hearing tried to make Delphi responsible for what had happened.
And speaking of Mary Barra, when she was before this Senate panel the first time, she got pretty well walloped. Were things any different for her this time? This is her fourth time trucking up to Capitol Hill.
Yeah, it was a very different situation. It's clear she has been meeting with Claire McCaskill. They have a relationship, it appears. There's some trust there now, and it looks as if they believe that she is doing whatever she can to make sure that this situation never happens again. So, she had to take some hard questioning about why Mr. Milliken was still with the company. But other than that, I mean, Ms. McCaskill actually congratulated her on the changes that she had made. So very, very different situation.
Because that senator blistered her the first time around.
It was brutal.
What comes next for GM on Capitol Hill?
I don't know if there's going to be other hearings. We haven't heard yet if there's any more, but we do know that they're going to be calling David Friedman back, who's the head of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And from some of the questions that I heard today, I think that's going to be another painful hearing for him.
Michigan Radio's auto reporter Tracy Samilton bringing us up to date on the hearings happening today for General Motors before the Senate panel. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Are we climbing out of the foreclosure hole that was dug during the Great Recession? That's the question tackled in a new report from RealtyTrack. They keep a close watch on real estate data. Its mid-year 2014 U.S. foreclosure market report came out today. Darren Bloomquist is here. He's a vice president with RealtyTrack. Darren, what is the word on foreclosures?
Well, the word is that we are at a national level and also in Michigan back to pre-housing bust levels. Where in June, nationwide, we saw 107,000 properties with foreclosure filings, and that may sound like a lot, but it's actually the lowest level we've seen since July 2006 nationwide. And July 2006 is a milestone in our minds because that's the month before housing prices basically crashed. In August 2006 was a peak in housing prices, and after that it was downhill for a long period of time during the housing crisis. So we're back to those levels. In Michigan, it was about 2,700 properties with foreclosure filings in June of 2014. And that was actually even better than what we see nationwide. Before the housing bust in Michigan, we were seeing an average of about 4,500 properties with foreclosure filings. So we're back to lower levels than before at least the nationwide housing bust.
Which leads to the question, why is this? What do you think is behind this slowdown, a very welcome slowdown in foreclosures?
Sure. I think there's a few reasons. Number one, the fundamental reason is that in many states, such as Michigan, there are some exceptions where we're continuing to see foreclosure activity rise, but in many states across the country, the market has worked through the bad loans that triggered the foreclosure crisis. Those subprime loans, those Alt A, interest only, negative amortization, no document type of loans that really got people into loans that they couldn't afford. We've worked through many of those. They've either been foreclosed or they've been resolved in some other way. And then the second reason is that we have seen home prices rise. Home prices hit bottom in March of 2012, and that is helping homeowners who are in trouble, who may be in trouble, regain equity in their homes, which gives them a lifeline to avoid foreclosure. The third reason is we've had very aggressive foreclosure prevention efforts that have made a dent and helped people avoid foreclosure. And that has also redirected many people who otherwise would have been going into foreclosure into loan modification or other alternatives.
What do you see as the key to staying on this positive track, not having these kind of bad mortgages creeping back up again? Memory gets a little vague as we move into time. What do we do to stay where we're going?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because we are already hearing calls for we need to loosen mortgages, and And I think maybe there is some need for balance, but I think we need to just remember what happened and that not do away with the assumption that everybody right now needs to be a homeowner. Not everybody at this point in their lives needs to be a homeowner. Homeownership is a great avenue for building wealth for many people, but it needs to be at the right time in their lives when they can actually afford it. And I think that will help. And I do think the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, is a necessary piece of this that's been put in place. It's going to help, that is there to protect consumers from basically getting repeating the mistakes that we saw of the early 2000s and getting into loans that they can't afford. So that's another piece of it as well going forward. And yeah, I think with those, it's going to be hard to not repeat that, because I think I still hear it, the desire to get people into home ownership and push them into that. And we just have to remember that's not for everybody.
As you look ahead through the rest of this year and into 2015, where do you see the numbers going, Darren?
I think the numbers are will continue to go down, and then they will flatline at a kind of normal historical level, sustainable. There's always going to be some foreclosures. There are circumstances that just come up and cause foreclosure. But I think in the second half of this year, particularly in Michigan, we'll see the numbers flatline and just kind of be stable in terms of foreclosure activity and not necessarily going up or down a lot. And I would mention that this doesn't mean that the market is completely healed in Michigan. This is one element, one piece of the puzzle that needs to be in place for a healthy market. But there's still a lot of fundamental problems with the Michigan housing market, unfortunately, that will take more time to heal. I mean, one of the major ones is negative equity. People who are underwater on their homes because of this boom-bust cycle that we've been in. And we're showing a third of homeowners in Michigan are still underwater. So that's still a big problem. But this is certainly one piece of the foundation that needs to be in place to rebuild a healthy housing market in the state.
Well, we'll take any piece of positive news that we can get in this direction. Thank you so much, Darren Blomquist, Vice President at Realty Track.
Thank you, Cindy.
Let's talk fish. The news that state officials recently approved an expansion of a northern Michigan commercial fish hatchery got us wondering, how important are fish hatcheries in the Great Lakes State, and how long have they been around? Gary Whalen is with the Michigan Department of Natural Resources, where he is a research program manager. Gary, when were the first hatcheries started in Michigan, and where?
Well, the first hatcheries were begun in the early 1870s. Our first hatchery actually commenced operation in 1874 in Pokegon. Prior to that, there was a federal hatchery down around the Detroit area that operated in 1873.
What was the reason they were needed?
Well, even by the 1870s, that people think as the good old days, our fisheries resources were in decline, serious decline across the basin. Most of the inshore populations of fish that people could get at with relatively small vessels and equipment that they had at the time were overexploited and, frankly, in very bad shape. Fish were difficult to find, and certainly a lot of the commercial fishermen were not doing very well. The inland fisheries were equally being overexploited, too many people taking too many fish beyond what the self-sustaining abilities of our systems have. In addition, of course, habitat loss was rampant at that time, everything from incredible pollution of our river mouths to the construction of the first large dams, most of which were to run sawmills and other sorts of mechanical power or for grist mills. In addition to that, of course, was a large-scale, essentially, mining of our forests, where we kind of came through and essentially cut the entire state within the first 20 years between 1870 and 1890. The entire system was essentially cut down, logs floated down rivers. The habitat loss was just pretty frightening and pretty amazing when you go back. So the 1870s were a pretty bad period, and one of the responses was to build fish hatcheries and put fish back in the water of various types. In addition, it was really the only tool they had available because the regulatory opportunities for those folks at that time were pretty much nil.
What is what's called the Fry and Johnny Fish Seed era?
Well, interesting, in the 1870s, the ability for fish cultures to produce large size fish for stocking was really beyond their abilities. They could do small numbers of them, but they were certainly able to rear large numbers of fry of various types of species. And some of them, of course, were native species that people wanted for food purposes. Things like lake whitefish are a great example of that, that, of course, are still an actively sought commercial fish on the Great Lakes, but certainly it was one of the major fish they were catching at the time. But the other part of the equation is the spreading of fish kind of willy-nilly across the landscape, which is sort of the Johnny Fish Seed era, where we put fish of every imaginable type everywhere you can imagine, everything from American eels from the East Coast, certainly the successful introduction and naturalization of brown trout populations. Chinook salmon were brought in, carp were brought in, and they were put everywhere you can possibly imagine. And part of that was because people like to bring their own foods and things that they're familiar with. Great examples are brown trout and carp from Europe. At that time, of course, we saw a large influx of European settlers. And they wanted stuff that they were familiar with. And those were fish they were familiar with, so that was the demand to rear those and put those in the water. And the Michigan Fish Commission that was formed in 1873 was responding to those demands by the populace.
And then, of course, through the 30s and 40s, we saw the sport fishing community just grow and grow. And then you call the period from 1964 to the present the holistic era of fish mm-hmm. hatchery expansion. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you just step back one short period back to what I call the instant fish period, instant fishery is really an engineering approach where we would produce fish of catchable size and put them in the waters. And for all intents and purposes, you were catching fish that you could buy at a market in our waters. And we did that on a whole-scale basis. But the price of that was unbelievable. Even in the 1960s, it was considered that the cost of a legal-sized fish to the creel was $1 apiece and $63, which is fairly expensive. So by the time 64 came around, there were two things that occurred at that time. One was a recognition we couldn't continue on the wholesale stocking of catchable size fish across the landscape. That was not sustainable. The other thing that was is that we wanted to turn the Great Lakes into an economic engine from a fisheries perspective for Michigan, certainly, and certainly other states grabbed on after us. And it was the recognition that you could use fish to shape ecosystems. And in this case here, we had huge numbers of invasive alewives that were there because there were essentially no predators to control them. And in this case, Chinook salmon and coho salmon, coho first, Chinook second, were brought in to control those fish and actually essentially biomanipulated and converted what was a huge crop of what many people thought were pretty worthless fish because they're washing up by the front-end loader fulls on our beaches and really soiling our beaches and converting them to a pretty remarkable sport fishery that we have today. So the idea is that you could bioengineer and use fish for various purposes, not just for sport fishing.
Fascinating. How many hatcheries do we have in Michigan right now, Gary?
We have 6 state hatcheries, and there are 3 federal hatcheries.
And what role do you see those hatcheries playing as you look into the future?
Yeah, they play 5 roles. 4 are the main ones. 1 is an additional one. The first one is to reintroduce extirpated species, species we've lost. Lake sturgeon, for example, on the Onondaga River is a really good example of that. The second is to provide for rehabilitation of degraded fish populations. Walleye stock, certainly in Saginaw Bay, is a classic example that where walleye had been essentially extirpated and lost by 1980. And because of the use of hatchery fish, we've rehabilitated. Now it's a world-class walleye fishery. The third purpose is for ecosystem balance, and that's what the one I referred to a few moments ago where we talked about using salmon to rebalance the system where we had way too many alewives and too many prey species and balance that into a balanced system that functions properly. The fourth reason is to develop new sport fisheries. You know, anglers pay most of our operating costs. We certainly have a responsibility to provide that economic benefit back to them and to the state of Michigan. Now, great examples are the use of muskies in many places, although muskellunge are a native species. There are many waters we put them in where they're not native but provide tremendous sport fisheries. And the last one, which is not used all that often, is that we do use them for management experiments or for research purposes. And that doesn't happen very often, but I think those 5 purposes will continue into the future.
Gary Whalen with the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Fun to talk with you. Thank you so much, Gary.
Thank you very much for having me today.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Sex with inmates, maggots in the food, smuggling drugs to inmates, and more. When is enough enough with Aramark, the food service company hired 7 months ago to feed inmates in Michigan prisons? That privatization was supposed to save the state over $12 million a year. But it has been a Pandora's box of troubles for state prison officials ever since Aramark took over, and that was just in December. Paul Egan is with the Detroit Free Press Lansing Bureau. Paul, now we hear four female Aramark employees at the Bellamy Creek Correctional Facility were fired for having sexual contact with male inmates in a walk-in cooler?
Yes, Cynthia, that's the latest.
That, I think, got everybody's ew factor just ramped up.
It's interesting. If you look at the number of employees that have been fired and banned from the prisons by month, it isn't getting any better. It actually started out high, it dipped a little bit, and then it's gone up again in the last couple of months. So, you know, one of the things Aramark said early on is we're going to have some transition problems, and we'll get through that, and things will improve. So far, at least, there's no sign that things are improving.
Well, it's quite amazing realizing that attention has become focused since the reports of the maggots and the food came out, and there seems to be quite a spotlight on Aramark, and things are only getting worse.
Right. And, you know, people that we do hear a number of comments from people saying, well, you know, not everything was perfect under the state employees. And that's certainly true. I'm sure the food probably wasn't something you or I would want to eat on a daily basis. And there were some incidents where state employees got in trouble, but there certainly wasn't anything like the volume of cases we're seeing right now where the numbers are, there's been over 80 Aramark workers banned from prison property. What I've gotten from the state is that, over the last 3 years, there may have been five state kitchen workers that got into similar types of trouble.
The Free Press used the Freedom of Information Act to obtain more than 3,000 pages of state records about Aramark. Your story for the Free Press has some pretty eye-popping reading. What did you learn?
Well, there were just a lot of complaints, and that you could kind of group them into a few categories, Cynthia. The other, sort of on a broader picture, the interesting thing was just the frank talk that you saw among wardens and the prison administration about these problems. Up until recently, they've been putting a pretty brave face on the situation, saying that that they're confident that the situation's going to turn around. But we saw emails where the corrections department manager in charge of administering the contract is saying he's at his wit's end, and you had wardens saying, you know, I warned them about this. If you lay down with dogs, you're going to get fleas, and just some very strongly worded dissatisfaction about this company's performance. And then I think you could group it into a few areas. Not enough food, lousy food, including we saw, you know, references to rotten meat, problems with sanitation, prisoners sneezing over food. These are workers that worked in the kitchen, dirty kitchens, portions too small, having to substitute things that didn't really make any sense. You know, there was a case where they ran out of juice for the prisoners, so they gave them popsicles instead. That doesn't really follow the prison standard menu. Then there's all kinds of security issues. Workers bringing marijuana, cell phones, other items that are not allowed into the prison. And what we saw is kind of a growing concern among some of the wardens about the fact that the prisoners were getting so fed up with this situation that they were concerned that they were beginning to act out and break things. In some cases, boycotting meals. There was a small hunger strike that took place at one prison. These were all incidents that had not been publicly disclosed previously.
Warning signs. Well, let's talk about Aramark. This is a big, big food service company. But there have been troubles with Aramark's prison food service. Kentucky, they had a riot in 2009 that was blamed on anger over the food.
Yes, and, you know, there's some disagreement about to what extent food was behind that riot, but that was certainly the view of corrections, some corrections officers and others. We should say about Aramark, just on the bigger picture, that correction services is just one of their business units. They're a huge multinational company. They deal with, they cater the arenas, sporting events, hospitals, private companies, even school districts, many school districts, and they're into also uniforms. So they're a big company. They're into all kinds of things. And, you know, to be fair to the company, their record in other areas, although I think you'd certainly have heard complaints about their school services in some districts, that, you know, we certainly don't hear this kind of complaint about, I think it's fair to say, not at this level, about their services generally.
That leads to the question, why are they doing such a lousy job with feeding prison inmates, not only in Michigan, but elsewhere? Florida, they canceled the contract in Florida with troubles, repeated complaints. Why is the prison service so rotten?
Well, you've got the ultimate captive audience. So first of all, and this is really a case where you're trying to keep your costs as low as possible. And so we're talking about, you know, feeding grown men three meals a day for a couple of dollars. And so that is going to mean taking a number of steps to try to save money. The other issue is when you try to come in and really lowball a contract like this, you're talking about paying workers $10 or $11 an hour. And that's been, it appears from everything that I've read and been told by various people in the prison system, that's one of the biggest problems here, because people that are working in a very stressful environment for $10 or $11 an hour, one, they don't tend to have a lot of skills and training, so to be important to train them very well. Two, if they get a better job, which for that kind of money may come along, they're going to quit, or they're maybe not going to show up. And turnover is seen as a real security problem. You don't want people, you know, new faces coming in to the prison system every day. That was one of the warden's initial concerns about this whole idea, was they don't really like outsiders coming into the prison because they like to have sort of control over their whole situation. And state employees, which were making, you know, roughly twice as much money, they certainly had a deeper stake in keeping that job and following the rules, and were also better trained in terms of searching prisoners and not being as easily manipulated, where you see these kinds of incidents where, you know, people are, you know, we saw ones where workers were baking special cakes for inmates because they were getting out of prison, or a large number of romantic incidents where workers were found with love notes to or from inmates. Or, you know, we had an earlier case in Carson City where they opened a walk-in cooler and found an Aramark worker and an inmate engaged in a sex act.
We need to talk about Lansing, because there are a couple of questions that come to mind. Knowing that there was spotty service with prisons in other states, why'd they get the contract in the first place? And then with this total cascade of events since December, why do they still have a contract?
Well, the first question is an interesting one, because the corrections department never wanted to do this in the first place. The legislature pushed this first by putting some language in the budget that required them to call for bids on this to see if they could get a better price. The corrections department had significantly reduced their kitchen costs over the last few years and felt that they, if given a little bit more time, they were going to be able to reduce the costs even further. The legislature didn't want to wait, said, we want you to call bids. They did call bids, and when the bids came in, they analyzed them and concluded that they really weren't going to save any money. Aramark and another company had put in prices that, when they factored everything else, both the Department of Technology Management and Budget, which are the budget crunchers, and the Department of Corrections, said, this isn't going to save us any money. Well, the legislature wasn't satisfied. They said, well, we don't like the way you've analyzed these contracts. We want you to go back and crunch the numbers again. And they actually went back, and one of the things that they changed is they had included that they were going to have to spend more money by putting more corrections officers in the kitchens, because unlike the state workers, these contractors wouldn't be trained in how to pat down prisoners, which the state employees were. And so Aramark came back and said, no, we'll train our employees. They'll be just as good in terms of security as the state workers. Well, today, these Aramark workers still are not able to pat down prisoners, and the prison administration, not the union, is saying that they're having to put more corrections officers into the kitchen to maintain security, to make sure the prisoners are not stealing food. So in that area where they got the contract sort of they got the numbers crunched over again, it doesn't appear that at least so far Aramark has been able to say, you know, what they said they were going to do, which would make the numbers all right.
And speaking of what they said they were going to do, it certainly seems that Aramark officials have been kind of hanging their official responses on this controversy over privatizing the prison food service, saying, well, we're not interested in the media circus about anti-privatization. But you found internal Aramark emails tell a somewhat different story than the public statements.
That's true. I mean, there were a large number of emails from Aramark managers to the district managers that kind of supervise these Aramark workers in the kitchens, and they're saying, you know, listen, guys, we're getting fined. This is ridiculous. I've told you guys to do better. Nothing seems to change. And in one email, the top Aramark official said, should I deduct these fines out of your paycheck, talking to the Aramark district managers? Now, whether that ultimately happened, I'm not sure. But yes, there was that level of dissatisfaction with the Aramark supervisors overseeing these prisons that Aramark was actually threatening to take the Michigan fined the company $98,000 for various contract violations, and they were threatening to take that money out of their paychecks.
I'm speaking with Paul Egan, who is with the Detroit Free Press Lansing Bureau, as we look at the many, many problems with the company of Aramark providing food service for inmates in Michigan prisons. So let's talk about the politics behind this, because the question has to remain, what would it take for Governor Snyder to yank this contract?
Well, Governor Snyder doesn't describe himself, at least, as a strong advocate of privatization. He won't even use the term privatization for this contract. He says he believes in competitive bidding and that you know, this was put up for competitive bidding and you know, that generally the lowest bidder should win. But there certainly is a belief among many, particularly Republican lawmakers in the legislature, that the private sector can generally do things better than the public sector. Now, if this, you know, it's kind of hard for them. I haven't heard too many of those lawmakers coming forward to defend the performance of Aramark on this contract. We have heard some talk that it's possible they'll, you know, rebid the contract or possibly even give it to the other private company that was the second lowest bidder, is another possibility if they want to stick with the private company. But it would seem at least that the state would get another chance at, you know, the State Department of Corrections would get another chance at putting in another price. The problem is so many of those trained employees are now doing something else. Many of them retired. Some of them actually became corrections officers because they were given first crack at a school for corrections officers that opened up shortly after this contract started. So, you know, if they do decide to cancel this contract and, you know, whether they would be able to kind of assemble the state workforce that they had before is really open to question.
This has to be giving Democrats quite the club to use against the governor.
Well, there certainly have been a lot of criticisms of the governor over this. The one thing I do find is, because it's prisoners we're talking about, you do get a lot of people in the general public that, you know, and you see this, the comments and the stories, well, you know, hey, they're prisoners, you know, feed them bread and water. I don't care if there's maggots in their meals or not. And, I mean, you can certainly, you know, one way you could say from a human rights perspective, that's not how we treat people in this country, whether they're prisoners or not. But you know, another way to look at it is just, look, we're paying this company $50 million a year to do a job. Are we getting our money's worth? And that seems to be a question that may have a little more political resonance, because nobody's going to go out really, you know, campaigning on a theme of I want prisoners to get better meals.
This is like this drip, drip of salacious headlines at times and stomach-turning headlines. What should we look for, Paul?
Well, a couple of things. One thing is the contract that the state signed with Aramark is, in terms of cancellation clauses, is actually a pretty good contract for the state. If they cancel the contract for cause, which is one of two ways they could cancel it, Aramark actually has to cover all the costs related to the cancellation, including possibly costs related to finding somebody to replace them. So, you know, they actually got some pretty good language in there if they can, you know, if they can make the case that they're canceling them for cause. And that's why this may be taking longer, if that's what they decide to do. This may take a little longer than some people might like, because if you're going to cancel the contract for cause, you really have to, you have to follow a procedure. You got to set up the steps. You may notice starting July 1st, they put Aramark on notice that they were going to start strict enforcement of the meal portion and menu substitution aspects of the contract. Basically, you know, you've been warned. If you screw up in this area again, you know, we can cancel the contract. We can fine you some more. What is a little bit less clear is why they haven't put them on notice on the fraternization familiarity stop order issue, why they haven't said, you know, there's been too many instances, because there's been dozens where Aramark employees have been fired for getting too friendly with prisoners. I would think that that we may see that happen, sort of the formal letter go out on that issue. And what the department has said is what their plan was at the end of July to kind of review things, how things have gone in July, and make a decision where to go from there. However, they haven't ruled out doing something sooner, and if things continue to happen like what happened yesterday, I wouldn't be surprised to see something happen before the end of the month.
Paul Egan is with the Detroit Free Press Lansing Bureau. Paul, thank you so much for the insight, and I have a feeling we'll be talking more about this.
Okay, Cynthia, have a great day.
Now, a personal note. Next week, my family and I will be leaving for a vacation in Europe. It has been a long time coming. One of the high points will be fulfilling my lifelong dream of visiting the hallowed ground of the D-Day invasion sites. We'll be going to Omaha and Utah beaches, and we will, of course, visit the American Cemetery there. And that's where you come in. If someone you know is buried at the American Cemetery near the beaches in Normandy, let me know, and I'll do my best to take a picture of the grave for you and to bring you some sand from Omaha or Utah, and most of all, to honor your hero. You can write to me at ccanty@umich.edu. That's ccanty@umich.edu, and I'll get right back in touch with you. Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia and Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and our engineer today was Peg Watson. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.